The Cold Omaha Podcast Network.
Hey, kiddies, it sucks that football season's over, but brand new, exciting development on the Cold Omaha Podcast Network. New show, the Andy, Luke, and Rhee Football Machine is kicking off. Pardon the pun. We got Luke Inman of eDraft. He's got his draft prowess and player development side. We got Arif Hassan of Everywhere. He's talking analytics and the thinking man side of the game. And we got me, Andy Carlson, who is also a person. Yeah. Show is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and of course, coldomaha.com/football machine, part of the Cold Omaha Podcast Network, baby. Let's go.
Back here for another episode of Midwest Swing. You can find us on Twitter at Midwest Swing Pod. I am your host, Brandon Warren. You can find me at Brandon_Warren on Twitter. I am, as always, joined by Andy Carlson, my producer. And you can find him on Twitter at Andy Carlson Show. This is episode number 16. And if I'm not mistaken, I did at some point, maybe on Twitter or something, call today's guest a repeat offender, but that's not entirely true. Today we are joined by Baseball Prospectus's Matt Trueblood. You can find him on Twitter at MA Trueblood. But Matt, I don't think we've had you on Midwest Swing. We actually had you on The Breakdown, or am I mistaken here?
No, yeah, that's right. That's right.
Okay. So, you know, Matt is coming to us actually, in fact, from the Twin Cities area as well. Maybe a lot of people don't know that, but as far as where you grew up, you were in the kind of, were you near Chicago? I know you were in Illinois, but where exactly were you?
Yeah, well, I actually mostly grew up in Wisconsin.
Okay. My mistake. Yep.
No, there are a lot of people who still think I live in Chicago just because big time Cubs stuff and all of that. But my family is from downstate Illinois. My mom's from Champaign. My dad's from Peoria. So a couple hours south of Chicago. And we moved up here when I was, well, not up here, up to Wisconsin when I was five, to Appleton, which is near Green Bay. So that's where I was until graduated high school, then went back to Chicago for college at Loyola and moved out here in August of 2011.
Now, I have a friend who grew up in Wisconsin and is a Packers football fan, but a Cubs baseball fan. Is that sort of thing typical, or is he kind of an anomaly?
No, and that's me too, and one of my best friends as well. Before the Brewers moved to the National League in 98, there were a lot of fans who were sort of bizarrely attached to National League baseball and wanted to follow an NL team. And obviously, so they followed the Cubs for that reason. And obviously it's also a big factor that the Cubs had the superstation throughout the 80s and 90s and even into this decade, reaching sort of nationwide. But if you were in Wisconsin and just a couple hours drive from Wrigley anyway, you know, the Cubs had almost as good a chance of getting their hooks into you as the Brewers did for a long time there.
Yeah, well, had we known you were a Packers fan, that might have changed things. Andy and I got to do a better vetting process of bringing on guests, but no. So what is your level of attachment to the other sports? You know, obviously anybody who follows you on Twitter, anybody who keeps up with you in online anywhere, I think, sees the passion you have for the game of baseball specifically, but do you have a strong gravitation towards football or basketball or anything like that? I know a lot of people are falling off the wagon when it comes to football for myriad reasons, but what's your level of attachment to non-baseball sports?
Fading. And not, you know, I still follow the sports some. I was a big, like everyone, but especially any kid who still visited family in Illinois a lot. I followed the second Jordan Bulls run. Mm-hmm. But ever since then, my interest in the NBA is sort of on and off. Football, you know, I was a big Packer fan while I lived in Packer land. then, you know, it comes and it goes. When they're, I have no shame in saying I'm a Fairweather fan. When they're going really well, I enjoy watching. I enjoy sending needling texts to my dad because he's a Bears fan, and messing with my family members out here who are all Vikings fans. But most of the time I'm lukewarm on the other sports, and especially now that in addition to family life, I'm covering baseball, you know, constantly looking for things to write about and pouring time into it that way. I just don't have that much bandwidth for the other sports.
Well, I think a good litmus test for Packers fans is if they can name more than two or three quarterbacks before Brett Favre that aren't named Bart Starr. And that's where, you know, you'd be exempted based on your age. I think you were born in the late 80s, a couple years after me. But at the same time, the people who will willfully ignore the Lynn Dickey era or anyone from that time, you know, the handful of quarterbacks that struggled very badly before Brett Favre was kind of bestowed upon that fan base. It's kind of funny to hear them talk about that. That's kind of the quarterback wasteland that the Vikings were in and, you know, arguably still are. You know, I like Teddy Bridgewater. You know, Brett Favre was obviously great in that first year, and Dante Culpepper was good. But if you look at the blanks in between those, it's pretty bleak.
And ugly.
Yeah. So you've obviously gravitated towards baseball, or baseball has kind of edged its way into your heart and pushed the other ones out. What went into that? How did that fire get lit, and then how did it become kind of a raging blaze?
Yeah, that's a pretty good question. It's certainly not, you know, not a like a natural affinity because I had an aptitude for it, because I didn't. I don't. My vision is terrible, and I couldn't play baseball after the age of 9. Like, once kids started pitching, I would have had no chance, because I just really bad eyes. So I never got to play the game on a real competitive level. But what I did was, basically, it boils down to this. My mom got my dad cable as a present on opening day in 1997. We finally had cable television, and he could watch the Cubs again.
Huge.
He didn't get to do it that much because the Cubs still played a lot of day games then, mm-hmm. and he would be at work. But I remember sitting down on the couch one day after school, turning on WGN and seeing the last few outs of this game that the Cubs won. This was mid to late April.
Of 98?
It was the first 97.
Okay.
And this was the first game they'd won all year.
Oh, right. I remember that stretch.
And Harry Carey, who is broadcasting his last season, says, as they're all lining up for high fives, "You'll never see a happier 1-14 team," which was just a joke, was a normal thing to say when your team finally wins after losing the first 14 of the year. But I heard it and thought, oh, well, cool. I like these guys. They've got some resiliency to them. And I just attached myself to them. I watched them the rest of that summer. I remember having a phone conversation with my dad about whether or not Jose Hernandez was good. And he
oh my.
Pretty correctly pointed out that he probably wasn't. But I breathlessly was trying to convince him he was by saying that he had 4 home runs. And, you know, to an 8-year-old who's playing T-ball and nobody hits a home run, I guess 4 seemed like a lot. And it took off from there. It probably traces to the first game that I went to at Wrigley, which was September of that year. And my dad drove us down. It was just me and him and his old pickup truck. We went down and skirted traffic and finally got to Wrigley Field. This was September, the last home game of the season. It was going to be Ryan Sandberg's last home game, so my dad wanted to take me there. And we had bleacher seats, dirt cheap, but mm-hmm. we got up there, and I couldn't see a thing. We hadn't really anticipated how hard it would be for me to follow any action from the bleachers, given my eyes.
Sure.
So we go back to this ticket services window, and just, you know, my dad kind of goes up and asks him, you know, is there any way I can get an upgrade? I'll pay a little bit, you know, we'll see what we can do. I mean, this was 97 before anyone went to Wrigley Field, basically. And so they said, yeah, sure. And we ended up like six rows behind the Phillies dugout.
Oh, wow.
And just, I remember so vividly just the scenes of the game and watching Harry Carey sing, which nobody knew it at that point, but that was the last game he ever did, too. And just I got really swept up in it. We went out to the player parking lot after the game. My dad's got me up on his shoulders so I can reach over the crowd to try and get an autograph. And Sandberg comes out, and he's my dad's hero. You know, mm-hmm. He's the hero of every Cubs fan of that generation because he was amazing. He was a Hall of Famer. But I only knew broken down, old, ineffective Ryan Sandberg. So I'm kind of like, yeah, Rhino, come on. Didn't get Ryan Sandberg's autograph that way, turns out. But then Sammy Sosa comes out, who my dad could have taken or left. You know, this was 1997, so it's still, yeah, he hits a lot of homers, but he strikes out so much, and he's so erratic in the field. And
right.
Sosa comes out, though, and I'm just, like, nearly toppling off my dad, reaching and screaming, and I got his autograph that way, and I was hooked from then on.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. I remember those teams too because growing up in a place where obviously the Twins games were broadcast too, I could see also a select number of Braves games on TBS and then WGN. Yep. You'd get some White Sox and some Cubs. So I remember watching like Steve Buechel play third base and Kevin Ory and a lot of guys who were definitely nothing special. Now I remember Harry Carey a bit too. Yeah, he I believe passed away like on a Valentine's Day. He was on a date with his wife the next spring and had a heart or health issue and had hit his head. So it is amazing that you had had seen his last game there. And it is amazing how sometimes those things resonate with you as a young person, but maybe it's a detail you would skip as an adult who's kind of right. going through the monotony of an everyday kind of experience. You know, for me, going to Twins games, for instance, is the kind of deal where that freshness and that level of awe kind of goes away, and then you kind of miss things. So I kind of like remembering those first game stories. Now, as far as, you know, a lot of baseball fans, you know, if you're on Twitter for more than about 10 seconds, you realize that everyone's got opinions. They've got to share them. They've got them all pent up and have to get them out. But, you know, not many of them actually, I think, go into writing specifically. What was the tie between baseball and writing for you that led you down that path?
That's another good question. I think it just sort of writing is more of what I was drawn to because of an aptitude where it was just something that always came naturally to me. You know, got great grades in those classes and constructing words always was, you know, that always held interest for me. So that passion just sort of bubbled up on its own and then merged with baseball as I got older.
And so when did you get your start? How did you get your start? I mean, obviously everyone starts either on their own personal blog. They start with an opportunity.
Yeah, in the sixth grade magazine that you put together with some of your classmates. Yeah, that was, I have been writing sports articles. You know, I've been reading them since I was 8, 9 years old. And so I just started, it made sense to me to start writing them whenever I got a chance, whenever I wasn't bound by some other subject. When I wrote, it would be about sports and especially about baseball and the Cubs. From the end of elementary school through middle school, I would write on the school paper. I would bend any subject that was too open-ended to be writing about sports in some capacity. You know, I'd write reflective essays about sports memories. You know, it was what I did. And then I got to, I started out in college doing the same thing, writing for the school paper at Loyola, and then discovered, this is my secret shame, discovered Bleacher Report in the fall of 2009, and the ability to just go on this website that other people read, and you could just write your own article and post it. It was amazing. So I started doing that, and I was with them for like 2.5 years in the end. I was writing my own blogs on the side too. I would start a blog and write like 6 entries and then abandon it and start a new one 4 months later or whatever. But I wrote for Bleacher Report for a long time through the end of college, just a little money on the side and really good exposure. By the end, I was, you know, one of the leading MLB writers, but I just didn't really like the confines of the writing.
No, I can totally get that. Your angle with blogs and starting them and then kind of abandoning them reminds me of how I play like baseball video games. Like I start a new franchise, play for a couple weeks, and I'm like, man, I want to start over. And so yeah. it's just funny how, you know, these things kind of just grow stale. But as far as baseball writing is concerned, is that your career right now, or are you doing something else on the side besides? I mean, obviously you're a father and all that stuff too, so you've got plenty going on at home. But yeah. As far as work, are you strictly a writer, or do you have other stuff going on?
Well, it's kind of a transition right now. Sure. Ever since I started at Prospectus, which was February of last year, it was a second job. My first job was actually taking care of my son at home. He was medically complex, and through a waiver, a federal waiver for people with certain, you know, extended needs, a parent can stay home and be paid to provide, you know, basically nurse level care.
We had that with my brother. Yeah. And I helped out with that. So I can relate to that on some level.
So that, I mean, that's been a huge blessing. It's really been, it's been helpful to the family and everything. But as probably most of the people who are listening will know, my son passed away on March 28th. So obviously that's not my main job anymore. Right now, writing is. But I don't anticipate that that's going to be my main career. I'm applying to other jobs right now and probably will be doing more of a traditional, you know, commute, do a job, come home and write at night kind of thing going forward. Mm-hmm.
So that's actually, it's a pretty good segue into, obviously we actually had you scheduled to be on the show around the time that things started cropping up for Emerson. And I don't want you to go down any path that you're not comfortable with, but you did in the last couple of days, I don't know if you posted it yesterday. I know that I saw it for the first time yesterday. You posted an article that made a very nice tie between a play by Joe Mauer, one of the most unconventional baseball plays you'll ever see on the field, and your personal circumstances and struggles. And honestly, when I wrote this up in the pre-show preparation, I just thought, you know what? I'm going to kind of give you free reins to just guide us through this story, because it was, for one, very well written, and I don't want us to give it away so people don't go read it. If you go to Baseball Prospectus and read this, it's called Rubbing Mud. It's Matt's latest column, as far as I know, or maybe one of the last couple. And so it's a must read. But Matt, take us through this, you know, in whatever detail you're willing to share, as far as your feelings towards this Mauer play and how it resonated with you on a personal level.
Sure. And so for people who don't know exactly the play we're talking about, this was Friday night against the Angels at Target Field. And, you know, Escobar hit a little flare or pop up into shallow right. But Eduardo Nunez and Miguel Sano collided pretty nastily. And so neither of them came up with the catch. The ball squirted away toward the foul line. And Mauer, who had been at first base, just raced out, picked up the ball, and fired to third. It was an amazing throw.
Throws and rope.
Yeah, and nailed Escobar. And it just, I didn't see it live. I was actually, we were doing other things. It's a lot of just sort of emotional maintenance and family time during the time that games are actually happening most nights. But I had gotten back up after getting my wife and my sons to sleep, and saw the clip that Friday night, and it just grabbed me, because it was this moment that I could empathize with in a new way, where and just to provide the quickest background possible, I said my son passed away on the 28th. He was four, or coming up on four and a half. And he had had hypoplastic left heart syndrome and Kabuki syndrome. He'd been very sick as a baby, and we made it through a lot just to kind of get that far. But obviously, I'm very much still in the grieving process, and it had been difficult early in the season for me to even really focus on baseball, because I just didn't see a lot of meaning in it. I just wanted things that I could attach to the memory of Emerson. I just wanted to be in that space, and there weren't a lot of intersections with the game. But when I saw this, it struck a chord, just because I always loved watching Joe Mauer, the catcher, and Joe Mauer, the player in his prime overall. He was obviously an amazing hitter, and whatever accusations certain local columnists may have liked to level over the years about his enthusiasm or his personality or all of that, I always watched Joe Mauer play catcher and just thought it was a human in their most beloved and natural space. Like, he would go after those pop-ups so well, or he'd pounce out on a ball in front of the plate and dive back to the plate to get an out. It was art, yeah. And it was just great. And
that play was great, yeah, against Brett Gardner and the Yankees.
Exactly. That play sticks with me, too. And it's just, we watched Mauer lose that. We watched, you know, in slow motion as knee injuries and back injuries and ultimately, most seriously and most scarily, concussions took that ability from him, where he could no longer play catcher. And he's just a first baseman, just a DH now. And you're so disengaged from the game. And I just have to feel like he feels as though a part of his baseball self is missing. Certainly how I would feel in the same place. And I know it's how I feel, you know, right now, that just a part of me is missing. And just to see that moment where he'll never really get back catching, but he got to be that engaged in the game again for a moment. And just the way he didn't freak out about that, and he didn't get too excited about it. He just didn't want to ruin it. He just got to live in that moment, and it was perfect. His response to it was perfect, and that just really touched me. And so I wrote about it, and people can go to the website and read all about it, but from there it's mostly exploring my emotions around it. But
but it's very good.
It was a cool moment, and I'm always rooting for Mauer. I'm glad he's off to a great start this year, and I'm especially glad that he got that play to just, man, show us that the arm is still there for sure, if nothing else.
Yeah, it might be over romanticizing, but I think it shows that we fall back on our instincts as human beings, even in situations where we haven't had to react in a way that we're used to for a long time. And so I think my favorite part, kind of under the radar of the gift that you shared, was as the throw is going, you watch the heads of the people involved, and they all snap to kind of watch as, like, you know, what in the world are we seeing? You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. And so it's who was, I think Eduardo Escobar had fully expected to be cutting off a throw, and to just watch him watch it sail and go, wow. Yeah, it was pretty cool.
Plus, Eduardo Nunez was involved in the play, and that's classic Eduardo Nunez, who is, you know, I had somebody tell me that Hunter Pence is in the conversation. Hunter Pence is probably actually the right answer, but Eduardo Nunez is hands down one of the most hilarious players in the game to watch, see how the game plays him. The helmet falling off, he gets hit by pitches. You know, he got hit by one where he thought he had broken his wrist, and I want to say it was in Kansas City. And then two or three days later, you know, he was riding a hot hand, you know, so he was batting leadoff. He gets hit in the same exact spot again, and he's just got this dejected look in his face. And he gets to first base, and Albert Pujols just kind of taps him on the face a couple times. Then he gets out to shortstop, and Andrelton Simmons is giving it to him. And it's just funny to see that human element of, like, you can have these people in your lives that hilarious things happen to, but it's just humanizing that, you know, at the same time, you know, these guys are the 0.1% or 0.01% of athletes in the world. That doesn't change the fact that, you know, that they're still human in many ways.
Yeah. Well, in Nunez, it's like I don't know any actual thing about Eduardo Nunez, the person, but you right. feel like you get to know him watching him play and the way he interacts with people, or, you know, constantly losing his batting helmet while running. It's there are so many little quirks and just the way people respond to it that they all seem to find him both amusing but also endearing. It's great to watch.
Well, and so yesterday he hit, I think, a double, or somehow he wound up coasting into second base and not losing his helmet. And I think that was more noteworthy.
I know. Than, and you know, it stands hitting, out when, yeah.
Yeah. He was hitting about 600 heading into yesterday's game. Obviously, small sample size caveats do apply. But, you know, it was just like, whoa, the helmet stayed on. Not, oh, this guy hit a double or this guy hit a single and stole second. It was his helmet stayed on. And that shows you that kind of level of cult hero that you can have. A guy that's not as obviously talented as a Joe Mauer in his prime, a Miguel Sano, or even a Brian Dozier or Trevor Plouffe. But he's just a fun character.
Yeah.
Now, it's kind of a clunky segue, I'll admit, but it's still along the same subject we were talking about. With Joe Mauer, and I think I've seen a lot of people write about him as far as whether or not he's back. Have you done any legwork as far as if you think there's a chance he can be, let's just say, split the difference between 2013 and 2014? What would you say the odds are that he could do that?
You know, I'm not sure that I know. I've looked at the numbers, but it's too early to know anything. You know, players right. will go through streaks like this throughout any season. When you watch Mauer hit, you always feel like he's still capable of getting it back because the swing is fundamentally there.
It's sound.
Yeah. Now the bat, you know, there's a problem of bat speed. There had clearly been a problem of vision, and so pitch recognition over the last year or two. I think, and maybe it's wishful thinking, but I do think he can get back to, say, that 2013 level. I don't think we're suddenly going to see Joe Mauer power hitter. Right. That home run he hit at the start of the season was great, but to me, it's not a harbinger of anything. His swing's still very geared toward the opposite field. Teams are going to keep shifting their outfield against him, and I think he's sort of gotten over the idea that he can adjust and work around that. I think he's realizing that he sort of is who he is as a hitter, and he's just going to have to be the best version of that he can. If he puts more balls in play and doesn't strike out as often as he did last year, if he can keep drawing walks, he's going to be a fine player. He just, you know, it's that 2013 level of performance that you're aiming for. It's not getting back to the actual Joe Mauer.
Yeah, and people will be quick to point out, too, Joe Mauer at the end of April last year, .318 batting average, .392 on base, .412 slugging. It's an .804 OPS. The next best month he had was July, .766. Otherwise, he was not above .725 the rest of the way. Now, the other thing that's worth noting, 14 strikeouts, 11 walks in 97 plate appearances. And so you're still talking about roughly a 14 or 15% strikeout rate. He's at about 6% right now, but there are still, let's see, what day are we today? The 20th. You still got about 10 days for a couple strikeouts to pop up and make it look like another 12, 13, 14% rate. So I don't think he's out of the woods yet.
No, and I think he can survive at 12, 13, 14%. If it creeps up toward 20, Joe Mauer can't succeed at that level. Lots and lots of hitters can, Mauer can't. So that's if he's in the lower half of the teens, he's going to be okay. If he's down below 10, that's amazing. That's great. He's got to avoid sort of the creeping strikeout issue that's been tearing down his performance over the last 2 years.
And he seems to have a much better 0-2 approach or two-strike approach. And I don't want to say it's approach because approach is the thing that he's actually been slavish to over his career. But he's had whatever it is that permits him to kind of hulk up and foul off 0-2 pitches that are tough or 3-2 pitches that are tough and then take a walk or, you know, single back up the middle.
I think it's his eyes. Honestly, yeah. I do. I think when he talks about having blurred vision the last couple of years, that it was pure hand-eye coordination that allowed him to be that two-strike, tough-out guy. And that just kind of failed him recently. And if that's back, then that's going to be an important – that's going to give us more of the Joe Mauer at-bats that we remember.
Now, shifting gears just a little bit, but staying within the Twins, again, I know this is a widespread podcast, but you're going to have some unique views to seeing the Twins that maybe I'm not privy to with a different set of eyes. When you look at this defensive alignment in the short term, let's not think about 2 or even 1 year down the road. What is the best defensive alignment in your mind? Defensive alignment with offense in mind, but not necessarily focused on. How do you line up this defense to keep the Twins from having what happened yesterday happen again multiple times?
We have to separate what I would do from what there's any chance on God's green earth of the Twins doing.
Well, true. Okay, so we can go down that road. We've got time.
Right, and because the Twins are just a hyper conservative organization, and now that the season has started, and they're looking failure straight in the face with Miguel Sano in right field, they aren't going to make a significant on the fly adjustment. What they're going to do is hope Sano gets better, start playing him at DH more. Maybe if Plouf is out long enough, they'll consider him at third base again. What I would do is try Joe Mauer in right field. And the Twins will never do that because they don't believe in having someone try to learn a new position on the fly. They have planted their flag in the camp of Joe Mauer can't play the outfield. I just have no idea why. He moves fine. He's got a great arm. And he's just such a natural baseball player. He can learn that. I don't see any evidence that Miguel Sano, this 275-pound monster who needs to be focusing on his offensive game, that's where his bread is buttered anyway, no matter what he does on defense. There is no world in which Miguel Sano is more important to you as a defensive or a positional asset than he is as a hitter. I would be moving Sano back to DH. I'd have Byung-ho Park playing first base, which he seems to be fine at, I would have Joe Mauer in right field. Maybe we're already too far down the road to do that, just realistically. I know we're too far down the road for the Twins to do that.
Okay, so if you're the Twins, though, can you salvage this then?
Yeah, I mean, I think they can. I think they probably need to switch Sano. They should explore switching Sano to left field just because the sun tends to be a little easier there at Target Field. He doesn't have to play weird hops off the wall. The fence is shallower, so there's going to be more home runs out that way, and he's not going to have to catch as many balls in the first place. I don't know why they ever put him in right field, but they did.
The arm. It's the arm and only the arm. In fact, Terry Ryan said at his media availability the other day, they believe that his arm, in terms of raw strength, is better than Mauer's, and it has a truer trajectory. He doesn't have any tail or anything on his throws.
I think that's true, but I think if you only get to show off your arm after you've whiffed on a line drive or you catch a ball that's going to be a sack fly and then you take two lumbering steps because you don't know how to set yourself under a fly ball, that your arm's not going to matter very often.
Well, it's the anti-Ben Revere problem where the Twins put Ben Revere in right field, and Ben Revere's got like this Chris Davis, Johnny Damon-style arm. But, if you can get a quick release and actually catch the ball, you're still taking two of the proper steps towards third one being shaky.
I remember watching Revere in right field, and just he stopped balls from getting into the gap.
Maybe
guys would still try for a double because it's Ben Revere's arm, but that would automatically be a double against a lot of right fielders. Miguel Sano is not doing that. He's got decent straight line speed once he gets going, but he's not Ben Revere. He's not close to Ben Revere, and he doesn't have the defensive instincts of Ben Revere.
I have to say that I bristle at the notion that people will say that Miguel Sano's body type mirrors Kenny Vargas's, though. And that's where That's what a lot of this comes from Twins fans, is like this David Ortiz, Kenny Vargas, and Miguel Sano. But like if Miguel Sano is a thoroughbred that just needs time to get moving, that's probably not, you know, well suited in a speed position, clearly. But from a body type standpoint, somebody tweeted this to me, and it's probably not too terribly far off. But Miguel Sano is like Shaq, and Kenny Vargas is like Oliver Miller. that just cracked me up.
Yeah, I mean, he's an athlete. He is. That's not the problem.
Yeah.
The problem is he's not a premium athlete. Like, there is a difference between being Giancarlo Stanton, who is Sano's size, but just he's really trim and really able to move. And the other thing is Stanton's been an outfielder for years.
Probably his whole life almost.
Yeah. And there's just such a big difference between having trained that way for so long and trying to pick it up on the fly when you are so big and it takes you a while to get going. And, Sano is an athlete. To me, that's not the problem. The problem is it's just not something he's shown an aptitude for. And they prepared him as well as they could have, I guess. But yeah. To me, they should have started this process a long time ago instead of insisting he was a third baseman right up until the moment that he was a DH.
I think the issue here is that maybe that get up and go thing works at third base as a hot corner thing with the arm. You know, it's probably not an ideal skill set, but I think he could hang out there. You know, you obviously saw the Tigers do that with Cabrera, and he's a better, obviously at this point in his career, a better athlete. He might grow into the size of Cabrera where he has to play first, and that's no big deal. But it seems like they're kind of mixing short-term and long-term repercussions, and they're leaving Sano, who is absolutely the most talented of the players affected at this point, whipping in the wind. Because it's like, okay, so you don't want to do wrong by Trevor Plouffe, who is a first-round pick of yours from 12 seasons ago. He did everything you asked of him coming up in the system, but he's probably not long for the Twins if you're completely honest about things. So, you know, are you trying to do right by Trevor Plouffe in the short term? Are you trying to do right by Joe Mauer in the medium term? Or are you just going to sack up and do right by Miguel Sano in the long term? And that's the issue that I think, like, they're trying to stand right in the middle of that, and it's not working.
Right. Well, and I think they think they're acting in Sano's interest by putting him in right field. They don't think he's going to be a third baseman. They don't want him to just be a first baseman or DH at 23. And I get those things, but I guess my biggest thing is it's just very clearly not working. And it's been very clearly not working since the beginning of spring training. And they didn't really pursue a solution. And in fact, they'd already boxed themselves in, which I like the Byung-ho Park signing, and I'm certainly not advocating getting rid of Mauer, but maybe you needed to be more realistic about the fact that in Mauer, you already have one first baseman / DH. And if you add another, Miguel Sano is locked into some valuable defensive position, and you might not want that as much as you think you do.
So we talked about short term, but long term, Even if you make the change now with a long-term view, and maybe that's what you had gotten to answer, but how do you change things up? I mean, do you start thinking about trading Trevor Plouffe and roll with that? I mean, what are you thinking?
I think pursuing a trade of Plouffe was a thing they should have been doing all winter, and it sounds like they loosely explored it, didn't like what they were hearing, and pulled the reins back. I like Plouffe. I like the player. I like how hard he worked to make himself a good and now more of an average, just because his range is already starting to fade a little bit. But, you know, a competent defensive third baseman and a pretty good hitter. He's David Fries.
He is.
Probably a better player than Fries, too. To me, they should have been exploring a trade of him sooner. And now I'd almost be pressing really hard on that button, just because, look, you're 4-10, and it's way too early to give up on the season, and I still see a lot of promising signs in the Twins. But at this point, you kind of know Trevor Plouffe isn't in the long-term view. You know that this season is somewhat in danger anyway. And Trevor Plouffe isn't, because he's on the DL right now, if for no other reason, he's not going to be the guy on which that this season hinges. If he can get back and get healthy, and someone will give them something for him, you know, a decent prospect, a good reliever, you know, whatever it is, I would pull that trigger and I would see if Miguel Sano can still play third base. But I think every action they've taken over the last year and change now suggests to me that they don't have any faith in Miguel Sano at third base, which if that's the case, then I don't know what his defensive future is, but it's probably not good.
And now the reason I don't think they've explored moving Maurer to the outfield at the beginning of the outfield or the beginning of the offseason, rather, the field was crowded. They did trade Aaron Hicks. Yep. It's got John Ryan Murphy, but it's still not necessarily uncrowded from the standpoint that you have Rosario, Buxton, you have Arcia, and then you also have Max Kepler, who's a really nice prospect. Yeah. Which is, you know, he's probably my favorite player out of them all, actually. I like Buxton, and it's hard not to look at what he's done so far and be a little bit concerned, but not necessarily off that. But, you know, Kepler, to me, looks like a kind of like a nice defender who's going to take walks, and that's really nice.
Yeah. No, I like Kepler, and I agree that when you just look at, if you just say Buxton is one outfielder, because it's too early to give up on him yet, at least, and then you're looking at a mix of Arcia, Rosario, and Kepler, you really have to hope that one of those guys solidifies themselves as one of the other corners.
I think the odds are high that one of them could. I don't think the odds are high that two of them or even three of them become average big league regulars in the long term.
Well, and what surprised me was I'm surprised basically that they've held on to Oswaldo Arcia this long. It seemed like the organization just loathed him for so long.
Right. Well, even the beginning of this year until he got this chance in the last week or so.
And I was never sure why. I kind of like the player. I know he's not a good defender.
He's lost weight and to the eye test, looks like a better defender this year.
I think so, too. I don't think he's going to be a plus in the outfield, but he's not killing you the way Sano is. And to me, I guess I felt like they were giving up on Arcia without saying so. And if they were doing that, I wish they had moved him out, gotten something for him, because there were teams who did value him more highly than the Twins, for sure. And then explored things like Maurer to the outfield. But it just isn't quite in the character of this front office to think that outside the box until they absolutely have to. Now, and I think that's a bit of a problem.
Now, on the Plouffe front, you did mention trading him for something. Let's just say, hypothetically, the Twins in the offseason could have moved him to the Angels. The Angels ended up trading for Yunel Escobar. Yep. It's actually worked out quite well for them. But a name that I heard, now this wasn't like a well-placed source or anything, but it was some buzz, was Trevor Gott, who ended up being part of the trade to the Nationals, did not make the Nationals opening day bullpen. That's not more necessarily about Gott, but I think rather how good that bullpen can be in Washington. But it's a guy with good stuff and shaky peripherals, you know, and you just need time for those things to work out. I mean, he could be a Ryan Pressly, you know, a guy that throws 94, 95 and just needs a little time to figure it out. Is that level of position player for reliever trade in the best interest of the Twins when you look at their farm system and how many power relievers they're trying to have descend on Minneapolis at once? I mean, are you throwing another cog into a machine that you're hoping spits out enough pieces to live with anyway?
Yeah. Honestly, where Plouffe is, I think they could have gotten more than Gott. And sure. Gott is, he's a weird case because he throws 98, but he doesn't strike anybody out. But I wouldn't mind if all the Twins got out of Plouffe was a reliever and the chance to make, to give Miguel Sano an honest chance at third base. So it really goes back to, are they willing to give him that honest chance at this point or not? If they've already moved on from the idea of Miguel Sano, future third baseman, then keeping Plouffe wasn't a bad move, and they probably should still keep Plouffe now, because I don't, you know, Eduardo Nunez everyday third baseman is not a good thing.
No.
But to me, they should have over the winter kind of not broadcast this, but taken the best offer they could get for Plouffe and then moved Sano back to third. When they elected not to do that, it sent a signal to me that they might just not think Sano can play third. And if that's the case, then they probably do need to hang on to Plouffe, but I don't know what they're going to do going forward, as even next season, because he's going to be an expensive, mediocre third baseman by next season.
Right. Now, before we come down the home stretch with some Cubs talk and let you talk a little about the NL Central, which this Twins talk went on further than I expected, but I'm glad you've been able to hang with us today. What is your takeaway from the early season returns on Byung-ho Park?
My God, look at that power.
Isn't it incredible?
Yeah, he's fun is my main thing. Like, he is clearly going to swing and miss a lot, but he's shown me enough of a batting eye that I just think, you know, he might be Yoenis Cespedes, only at DH, and that's not the world's worst thing. Cespedes would obviously be less valuable if he couldn't play well in a corner outfield spot, but he'd still be a good player.
It'd be a lot of fun still.
Yeah, he's not going to walk 10% of the time, but if he can just maintain that 330-ish OBP and constantly be mashing, hit 30, 35 homers. Yeah, I think from everything we've seen, Park can do that, and he is fun to watch.
Before we dive into that, I do have to read a couple things here. Ticket King Online is running a deal this month with Midwest Swing. If you go on to TicketKingOnline.com, use the promo code... I have the wrong one up here. That's embarrassing. If you go to, I believe you have to do Swing. But anyway, they've got some cheap Twins tickets for the upcoming homestand here after they come back from the road trip that takes them to Milwaukee to complete this home-and-home and Washington. Again, Ticket King, they got offices in each of the Twin cities. Get good deals on Twins tickets and really any tickets in the entire metro area. They do have right now, I believe it's if you use the promo code SWING, you get 10% off an order of – actually, it's $10 off, excuse me, an order of $50 or more. So, again, that's TicketKingOnline.com. Also, if you go to coldomaha.com/Amazon, you can use your Amazon how you always would, whether it's Amazon Prime, Amazon Pantry, or any of those different features that they have. But we get a little bit of a kickback from it, so we'd be happy if you did that. That's coldomaha.com/Amazon. Or if you're visiting, whether it's the Midwest Swing, Andy and Luke and Arif's Football Machine, any of those websites, they'll have the advertisement that you can click on. It'll take you right to Amazon. Nothing changes for you, but you help us out. So that's coldomaha.com/Amazon. Now, Matt, we had kind of, I think, touched about the Cubs off season a little bit the last time we had spoken, but as they've headed into the season and the results have been positive thus far, you have to take away from the fact that they pretty much nailed that off season, don't you?
Oh yeah. Yeah. They couldn't have done a whole lot better. They basically identified several major areas of need over the winter and then went and hit all of them. And I think having Dexter Fowler fall back into their lap didn't seem like a huge deal at the time. And now that Kyle Schwarber is hurt, it comes up a little bigger. They'd have had Chris Coughlin if they didn't have Fowler. And so, you know, it's not as though they would have been totally left swinging in the breeze. But the depth that they amassed on both sides of the ball, really, and the way they rounded out their run prevention by adding Hayward and creating a defensive picture that just works a little better than it had in the past, there's nothing you can complain about with what they did this winter.
Now, when I would talk about Hayward on a national standpoint, quite frankly, there were 29 teams in baseball that could use Jason Hayward. Yeah. And then the other one was the Pirates. And so right. he's obviously been a real revelation for the Cubs. But at the same time, I have to ask, how has his presence and Fowler's presence kind of lessened the blow from that catastrophic injury for Schwarber? I'm sorry to bring that up. I'm sure that's probably not very fun to think about. But at the same time, it sure has to be nice for that to happen when you've got, you know, Soler in your back pocket and you know, yeah. Baez that can do a lot of fun things for you. You can play Bryant in left field and Tommy La Stella at third base. That level of flexibility has to make Joe Maddon look like even more of a genius than he already is.
Yes. Yeah, the organizational depth is just mind-blowing. And adding Hayward and Fowler, or, you know, re-adding Fowler this winter, that smoothed over a lot of things because you just, you know that the top of the lineup is secure. Now, Hayward, excuse me, Hayward's had a really, really hard start to the season. And there were some adjustments that I'd hoped he would make under Cubs hitting coach John Mailey, who likes to tinker a little bit, likes to get guys doing what they're trying to do instead of just what they've always done. I had hoped he'd make some of those adjustments, and he hasn't done anything differently so far. He's struggling at the plate, but just defensively, he's a huge standout. And to be able to have him in right and Jorge Soler in left, where his arm plays up and you just don't have to worry about him as much. Yeah, Schwarber or no Schwarber, he's been a huge addition.
Now, you did say something, I don't remember what point of the spring it was in, but you said that you had viewed the Cubs winning the World Series as likely as possible. Now, you got a significant significant amount of heat for that, but I felt like, as an unbiased observer, I understood what you were saying, and I wasn't really using it, you know, as a hot take, lightning rod kind of thing. Basically, to me, and we had discussed this over direct message just because I wanted to clear the air and make sure that I was reading into it the same way you were. It's basically viewing this is the Cubs' best chance with this roster currently constructed to win a World Series. If they were ever going to win a World Series, this would be the way to do it. Is that pretty close to what you were going for?
Yeah, basically that, I mean, by no means was I suggesting that they're more likely than not to win the World Series or anything
like
that.
Which would be wild just because there's 30 teams.
Yeah, there's an extremely low practical maximum of World Series win probability for any team entering a season. They have to survive 162 games and then three rounds of playoffs. We're at this point where if you have more than a 8 or 9% chance of winning the World Series on opening day, that's nuts. And I just think the Cubs were very close to that practical maximum where you can't be a whole lot better positioned on every front. You can't be a whole lot better prepared for every eventuality than the Cubs were. And to me, they were also, especially by opening day, as the Dodgers got depleted by injuries and stuff, pretty clearly the best team in baseball. And so if you're the best team and you've got a ton of depth and you've got, by loose consensus, the best manager in the league, you know, you're at this point where there's nothing else you could do to be better positioned to win the World Series. Yeah, it doesn't mean it's going to happen or even is likely to happen, just that it's as likely to happen as I think it could possibly be.
So you collect assets and you say, let's play, basically.
Exactly.
So that comment to me kind of solidified your role in baseball Twitter. And I love baseball Twitter and I hate baseball Twitter at the same time. I have a very much love-hate relationship with it. Yeah. What do you feel your role is in baseball Twitter? And have you embraced it, or is there part of you that doesn't necessarily love it?
I think I probably go back and forth more than I'd care to admit on how I feel about it. For the most part, I don't like the concept some people have of me that I am intentionally throwing out hot takes. That's not what I'm doing.
Sure.
And I do, on the other hand, think that baseball Twitter has tended at times to be too quick to consensus, too quick to embrace a move, too quick to say, well, we don't really get this move, but this front office knows what they're doing, so we'll let them off the hook, that kind of stuff. To me, we are not at the point where we know that teams know better than us in all cases. And that's the one thing that grinds with me the most, is when people just say, at this point, the data is so much better on the other side of the curtain that you can't argue. No, I think we still can. And I think we can still try to do better. I think we can still try to just advance the narrative so that we're not even if we don't know quite as well as the teams, that we know a lot better than we do right now. We have sort of slowed down the old baseball prospectus objective of kind of educating the common fan and advancing sabermetric principles. That's decelerated a lot lately, and I'd like to push it a little more. That's my thing, is I think we can still do better. I think there are some... Well, my biggest hot take, the thing that people got most worked up over...
I think I know what it might be.
...was probably when I said that the Cubs should at least consider not extending Theo Epstein after this season.
Yeah, I remember that one.
and that got me a lot of accusations that I was intentionally being contrarian, just saying the opposite of what everyone was thinking. And that's not what it was. You know, I do respect what Theo Epstein's done. In fact, I think he might be the best executive in the game. That doesn't mean that he should stay in one place and be the top executive for one team for a long time. Lord knows there are plenty of Twins fans listening to this podcast who can tell you that someone's a great executive doesn't mean they'll be a great executive or the right executive for one team for 20 plus years, Terry.
yeah. I love Terry. Don't get me wrong.
Oh, he's a wonderful human being, and he's a great baseball mind. There also came a point, and it was multiple years ago, where he was no longer the right person to be in charge of the Minnesota Twins. There is a danger of just stalling out in everything we do. Everything we do, we should be exploring new ways of thinking about a problem, new people to get a chance to think about the problem that way. Frankly, I don't know how people have managed to do this, but like, you'll see tons and tons of people saying, we need more women and more minorities in charge of baseball teams. I agree with that entirely. But they'll also say, don't you dare, you know, try to unseat Theo Epstein or suggest that Sandy Alderson might need to move on from the Mets soon or Dayton Moore should have been fired from the Royals before the Royals got good. To me, all of those things are true. And if any of them would actually happen instead of these people, and again, great people, but largely Eastern educated white men who have gotten into their positions and just sat there and stayed for 10 years. That is a huge part of the reason why women and minorities and just people who think about the game differently can't get a foothold, can't change the way things are done. And so I think we need to open up a little bit and not suspect anyone who advances an idea in earnest of having ulterior motives. I'm never, ever posting that. Something for clickbait. I don't see the value in clicks. I don't even know. Honest to God, since I started at Baseball Prospectus, I can't tell you how many clicks any of my articles have ever gotten. No one's told me, and I've never asked. What we should be doing is trying to think about things in new ways, because if talking about baseball and writing about baseball isn't advancing our ability to open our mind and turn a problem over in ways that we can apply to things more important than baseball, then we're wasting our time here.
No, I definitely agree with that. That's pretty well said. You know, it's, for me, it boils down to like trying to get a lot of people into these jobs too. There's just a finite small number of these jobs. And so it's hard to always feel like it's going to be an adequate sampling of the type of people who are applying for them. So it is good to see measures to get the game more diverse, but to expect overnight results is tough too, because you are, you know, fighting against the channels of a league that has been in place for, you know, well over 100 years. So,
definitely.
Yeah. So when you assess the rest of the division, not to cut short this Cubs talk, because obviously the Cubs are fun and great, is when you look at the rest of the division, I mean, clearly the Pirates and the Cardinals are the class of the rest of the division. I saw the Brewers up close the last couple of days. They are not in that conversation. Milwaukee is in a rebuild, obviously, and Cincinnati's in a fun transition period where they've got some interesting pitchers and some old position players, but not necessarily on the front burner. But if you had to choose one or the other, are you watching closely the Cardinals or the Pirates as the chief competition in the Central?
I picked the Nationals and the Cardinals in the preseason as the NL wildcard teams. So I think I have to say the Cardinals. The Pirates are a good team. I'm just not convinced that they've moved forward at all. And there's always, you know, if you're not going forward, you're going backward in this game, and especially in the National League Central this winter. Whether it's ownership being a little too tight-fisted or whether there are actual, you know, financial obstacles to spending more money on the Pirates, I can't say for sure. I have my suspicions, but I can't say for sure. But one way or another, their winter was not the winter you should expect of a team who has three times in a row won the wild card, won 98 games last year, has this phenomenal core led by an MVP who's never going to be any better than he'll be this year or than he was last year. I mean, Andrew McCutchen is not still on the way up. He's not on the way down yet, but you've got a window here. Yep. I didn't think the Pirates did everything they could to jump through that window.
Feels a little bit like the Twins about 10 years ago.
Yeah, kind of. It was disappointing to see.
The Twins never had that talented of an outfield, but the idea of their self-imposed financial stuff. Again, the Metrodome did cripple their finances a bit, but we'll never know to what extent. But it's always frustrating to see a team on the upswing that doesn't jump in with both feet.
And especially, you know, even those Twins had the excuses of the Metrodome, which no one came to even when they were good, and of not all that much common money available to them. The national TV deal has exploded in the last 10 years. The Pirates' payroll is over half covered by the money they get from national television. So, to me, they should be spending more. And if they did get serious about spending more, I like the John Jaso move. I think it's a neat little, you know, Oakland A's style move, except the Pirates don't need to be acting like the Oakland A's of the money.
Or the Tampa Bay Rays, for that matter.
Right. That shouldn't be the model anymore. Because there's more money available, player salaries have not increased the way revenues have, and you should be able to go and find solutions that aren't as quirky as John Jay. So aren't as quirky as Juan Nicasio, as much as everyone is sure that Ray Searidge is going to turn Juan Nicasio into Walter Johnson. He's not. He hasn't. He won't.
Or Justin Masterson, for that matter.
Exactly. I like the Pirates. I think they'll be an above 500 team. I think they might have missed their window here, and I think the Cardinals are underrated on a lot of fronts. I think people, when they lost Hayward, when they lost Lackey, they just sort of lost the narrative. But the Cardinals still have a lot of pitching depth, and Stephen Piscotty and Randall Grichuk are maybe not as good as some Cardinals people think, but better than most people think, to my eye. And I think if your core is Grichuk and Piscotty and Matt Holliday offensively, and you're still got a pretty good run prevention machine going, they're going to be a really competitive team, and I think they could make the playoffs. I'm encouraged by their start at the plate, although it's a little just homer happy and probably unsustainable, but we'll see. I would lean Cardinals. I think both teams are going to win between 85 and 90 games. And it might be a race to the finish.
Okay, so before we let you go, I do want to get your view on the two rebuilding teams in the Central, just quickly here. Obviously, I've seen the Brewers up close and personal. That's a team that will probably hit quite a bit, but I don't think their pitching is very good at all. Although I do like Will Smith when he's healthy. Jeremy Jeffress is pretty interesting. And then the Reds, you know, that rotation is kind of fun. You know, I like Raisel Iglesias. I like Brandon Finnegan. But it's a team that doesn't necessarily know its identity right now, I think. And I don't think they've fully embraced the rebuild, but they got rid of Todd Frazier anyway. So I'm a little confused. What's your take on these two teams before we let you go?
Well, I think the Reds have fully embraced the rebuild. I think they caught a bad break with Chapman. You know, it's not their fault what Aroldis Chapman did. And what he did killed his market value. Just plummeted it. The trades of Cueto and what Frazier and Chapman show me that they're serious about rebuilding, and they tried to trade Jay Bruce right before the season. I think they're going to end up feeling very happy that that trade got nixed, because Bruce is off to a great start, and he has all of this potential that people had started to give up on. If he can flash it for even 3 months, they're going to get a better haul for him than they were poised to get in that three-way deal in March.
Definitely.
They're sort of saddled with Joey Votto, so I don't think moving on from him or moving him and getting anything significant in return is an option, both because of his contract and because of his no-trade clause.
It's like the Joe Mauer of Cincinnati.
Right, right. Or the Ryan Braun of Cincinnati, to tie
that's
up
probably,
to the other
rebuilding
NL Central team.
Although, Saris told me he thinks that Votto could be part of the next good Reds team, and that he thinks it could be a relatively short rebuild. Now, he also thinks, though, like he said, it would be because he could still be a decent player at that point, which
yeah.
I go back and forth on, but I think I lean more towards he could, just because his approach is so good.
Yeah, Votto's, I mean, he's such a good hitter that I tend to think he can weather the storm and still be helpful, if not fully Joe Votto, fully Joey Votto, right, when the Reds are good again. I think I agree that the rebuild could be short, but they're going to run into this problem of a buzzsaw all around them, where the Pirates' farm system is still strong. I may not like the offseason they had, but that doesn't mean they're permanently on a downslope. The Cardinals are going to be the Cardinals, and I don't think they're going to run out of gas next season or anything like that. The right. Cubs look like this years-long juggernaut, and then there's the Brewers, and I love the Brewers' rebuild. I like the Reds' rebuild. I love the Brewers' rebuild. Emphasis on bats over arms. A guy drawn from the Astros school to make Astros-like decisions. It's perfect. Everything they're doing is perfect. Can't wait to see what they get for Jonathan Lucroy. The Reds and the Brewers are kind of on these equivalent tracks, and you can almost go, is one of them going to be able to move their Braun or Votto or just get the most out of that guy? And which one is going to get more out of Lucroy and Bruce? And once those questions are answered, I'll know a little better which one I think is going to rise into the contending class in the NL Central again sooner. Right now I'm leaning Milwaukee, which puts the Reds really into some trouble. Because if they're stuck in a long rebuild, it's going to be bad. Going to be bad for their fan base, bad for their revenue, bad for everything.
Whereas I think bad for Joey Votto.
Yeah, and I just think the Brewers can weather that a little more because, well, for multiple reasons. But I do think the Brewers are closer. I like what both teams are doing, but they're going to have this long hill to climb just because of their competition, too.
Well, that's all I have for you today. I wanted to thank you for taking time out to join me. I'm glad we could get it rescheduled. I'm glad that you had time to fully, or not fully, but at least process some of the things going on in your life, and that we could help you hopefully get some of that out today, too. Again, if you have not read his piece, Rubbing Mud, about Joe Mauer, Rubbing Mud, I believe, is the column, but the Joe Mauer article was part of that series. And so give it a look on baseballperspectives.com. It's absolutely worth your time. Stay tuned to the Cold Omaha Podcast Network, especially Midwest Swing. We should have a special, hopefully, episode with Tom Schreier joining me to kind of recap the Twins homestand that they just came off recently. Otherwise, thanks for joining us and have a wonderful day.
Hello, my name is Zachary Bennett.
And this is Tim Fakeless.
And we are your co-hosts for the Wolves Wired podcast. Be sure to tune in to the Wolves Wired podcast on Monday mornings. We are part of the Cold Omaha Podcast Network. Now back to your regular programming.
Hey guys, and before we get to the show, just want to let you know, brand new podcast called The Andy Carlson Show. Original, I know. Sports and other stuff coming at you 5 days a week, part of the Cold Omaha Podcast Network. So, get up the show. Visit andycarlsonshow.com/podcast or get it on Stitcher and iTunes. All right, on with the show.
Hey guys, this is Tom Schreier, co-founder of ColdOmaha.com. Thank you for listening to the Cold Omaha Podcast Network. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast on iTunes and leave us a comment and a rating. Also, don't forget to check out ColdOmaha.com to see all of our podcasts and read articles about your favorite teams in the Twin Cities. If you have any suggestions or comments on anything related to Cold Omaha, email us at editors@ColdOmaha.com or follow us on Twitter at ColdOmahaMN.
The Cold Omaha Podcast Network.